I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
All right, we're back for another one, folks. And this week, this week we get real butt heavy. We're talking about cheeks. Actually, we're not talking about cheeks. We're talking about what's between them cheeks. Actually, we're not talking about what's between them cheeks. We're talking about what is between them cheeks and in just a little. Not too far. Just a little. We are joined by Dr. Gary Bucher, who is... he's a doctor who specializes in anal dysplasia. He works out of the Anal Dysplasia Clinic Midwest, which is a spot in Chicago that is diving into the research and the treatment of anal dysplasia. If you don't know what anal dysplasia is, well, it's sort of to do with cancer, kind of something to do with anal cancer, but not quite, but sort of. It's on the way. This conversation is an absolute joy. Dr. Bucher is, he's the ideal sick boy, medical professional guest. He hits us with the stats. He hits us with the science, but he also hits us with the odd asshole here and there. And he was a real joy to shoot the shit with. The three of us had an absolute blast with him. We look forward to having him on the show again in the future at some point, I'm sure. And stick around for after that conversation. Brian Taylor and myself do a little deep dive on polio, and we reminisce about a man who we are big fans of that we've talked about on the show before, who is a massive polio advocate. Hope you enjoy this, and we'll see you in the wrap-up. All right, guys, we're going to be talking about butt stuff, and but in a way that is far more dialed in, scientific, and professional.
Not than your typical.
Not my typical butt stuff, conversation. That's right.
That's good.
Sick boy butt stuff, which is very different, but we're not going to go there. Today, we are very honored to introduce our new friend, Dr. Gary Bucher.
Bucher.
Bucher. There you go.
Not Butcher. The guiding force behind the Anal Dysplasia Clinic Midwest, a center for excellence, a center of excellence for over 15 years. Dr. Bucher has played a crucial role in providing top-tier care to people living with HIV and other high-risk groups, specializing in HRA. We're going to get into that. I don't know what that stands for. And anal precancer treatments. His leadership at the Anchor Study site leads to significant contributions to research on anal cancer precursors. As a testament to his dedication, Dr. Bucher has trained more providers in HRA than any other site at the 24 Anchor Study sites, marking a notable achievement in patient care and medical education. I got a lot. That intro.
We are not worthy.
Yeah. That and just a couple of questions right off the bat before we kind of like get you to introduce yourself, Dr. Bucher. But what's HRA? What's an anchor study site? Those are two that I'm not familiar with.
All right. HRA. Let me just get that out first. Stands for high resolution endoscopy.
Okay.
Fancy terminology for looking at your asshole with a microscope.
Okay. A high res
easy
microscope. Great. Yeah, right. Nice.
Wow. A high resolution microscope.
That's the kind of language we understand.
Yeah, I like that.
and The anchor study is a big study that's just kind of winding down now, and it's an anal cancer prevention study. Okay. So I can kind of tell you a little bit more later about, you know, what that entails. But
cool.
My practice in Chicago, really all we do all day long is that we evaluate and treat HPV-related anal disease.
Ooh.
So we see a lot of assholes every day.
Well, yeah. I heard that.
And I love my job.
Yeah. Literal assholes and figurative assholes, or we're just talking mostly literal.
Mostly literal. You know, you do get a few of the others too.
I'm curious. I heard that that it's possible to use your asshole print as a identifier. Like everybody has a different,
like your fingerprint.
Yeah. Like a
everyone
fingerprint.
Has a unique print.
Right. But, so if a serial killer like burns off their fingertips so that they don't get caught, you could
swab for like where they
theoretically
sat or
print
like
their asshole.
Is that true?
I mean, they'd have to be sitting totally naked and spreading their cheeks quite wide and somehow maybe covered their asshole in ink.
Let's ask the doctor, Jerry.
Yeah, go ahead.
That is false.
Oh,
okay, good.
You heard it here first, folks.
I'm going to have to add that to my myths on my website because I've never heard that before. That's a good one.
Myth busted.
I believe that was Salvador Dali, I think, was the one that came up with that. And he's a bit of an ass. Before you go any further, first, doctor, not Butcher, Booker, please take a moment to introduce yourself to us and our listeners. Give us a bit of insight into who you are, the kind of work that you do, and how you kind of found yourself where you are today.
Okay. My name is Gary Booker. I family medicine trained. Since medical school, I've been practicing HIV medicine. So that was in the 80s when AIDS was a big issue. And through my residency and early years in private practice, I did HIV primary care. And what I found is that anal cancer was increasing in people with HIV. So I started incorporating anal pap smears into my preventive HIV practice. And I would get abnormal pap results, just like women when they go for their cervical pap, they get an abnormal cervical pap, they go to their gynecologist. So I sent them to a colorectal surgeon to be looked at. And what would happen is that the surgeon would put a clear anoscope in and say, and do a rectal exam and say, everything looks normal. So, and I knew that's not the workup for what we should be doing, looking for precancer areas. So I started to learn how to do HRAs, high resolution endoscopy. I did a couple of preceptorships in New York and San Francisco, bought my equipment, and I incorporated that into my practice. And so I'm like, well, I can do this. I should connect with other HIV providers in Chicago who should be doing pap smears. And if they do and they're abnormal, they should send them to me. But I didn't get any referrals from them because they thought I was probably going to steal their patients because I also did HIV. So about 10 years ago, I made a clean break, stopped doing HIV medicine and strictly focused my practice on this. And I've been building it up since then. And because of that, I was part of that big anal cancer prevention study.
I'm really curious, Gary, on the, I have a bit of a fascination with the kind of the emergence of HIV in North America, the like stigma that surrounded HIV, in particular the gay community, and, as somebody who was, you know, working in medicine in that time, like the 80s and 90s, and working with in HIV in particular, like, what was that? Like, what was that era like from a medical professional perspective?
So that time, so medical school is already crazy. Because, you know, you're working all the time and residency is crazy because you're basically working every day, almost every, all hours of the day. And that time now is kind of a blur because
all the people, cocaine.
All of that, because you had to keep going. And I went to a 6-year medical school. So I went in right after high school. So, you know, I didn't do my 4 years of college and 4 years. So everything was kind of like combined with partying, studying, learning. So it was crazy. And to me, it was even more intense when you put HIV on top of it, because so many people were dying that you would see. In my private practice after residency, it was an HIV practice. And that was in the early 90s before we came out with the medication that actually saved everyone's lives. But, you know, I would have 3 or 4 people of my patients die a week.
Wow.
Plus, I would be making rounds at the hospital where we would have 30 people in the hospital, plus doing all day senior patients.
Did you find that take an emotional toll on you?
It did. And I actually, in the end of around 1999, I just needed a break. I've had too many people die, and my partner at the time also died. And every time I would go to the office, you know, every half hour, my patients would say, "How are you doing? Are you okay?" And it was really difficult because I couldn't get past it because it was always in my face. So I actually quit, and I moved to San Francisco, bought a motorcycle, and I didn't know anyone there. And I did temp jobs. So I was, you know, like a Kelly doc instead of a Kelly nurse. And I would go do urgent care. I would get on my bike, get a contract to go to Napa from the city, drive my bike there, work overnight, worked at San Quentin for 2 months just to not do anything HIV related. And then I worked in a health and wellness company as medical director in Phoenix for 5 years. And then after that, I was healed. And I came back to Chicago and resumed where I left off, and the environment was totally different then. And that's when I did HIV primary care, then switched over to HPV anal disease.
Were those like your eat, pray, love years?
Yes. Yeah, it was.
I feel that.
So I went through that whole process, and I'm in a good place now. I'm happy. I love what I do. It's fun work, helping a lot of people, but then I really get to focus on one specific area of medicine, which is great.
I find that really admirable that you had the like awareness to know that you needed to step away, and you know, like describing it as being a really difficult time, and you know, constantly being reminded in your work of, you know, the challenges that you've been through personally and professionally at that time. I can understand why you would want to take that time to sort of leave that focus and go and do these other things. But at the same time, I think that a lot of people, even when they're struggling in those moments, aren't able to like sort of step back and, you know, change their career direction at that time and get out of that space so that they're able to like go through that healing process. So,
I mean, especially in healthcare, like I feel like, especially, you know, thinking of, We have a lot of nurses that are close to us. My partner's a nurse. She was in the CVICU for like 7 years. And even her mother, who's a nurse, my mom's a nurse, you know, it's like, and speaking to them, especially nurses that are in like really high intense places like NICU or cardiovascular intensive care or, you know, any of those places, it almost feels like, it feels like you're almost, it feels like talking to someone who is like a you know, a soldier in war. You know, it reminds me of the Hurt Locker, where the guy goes over and he's defusing bombs, and it's like, it's chaos, and everybody in his life is like, okay, you're done now. Like, thank God you're home. And he's just like, yeah, but you know what? I got to go back. And everyone's like, what the fuck is wrong with you? It's like, there's this, this lack of ability to like pull back to see how truly intense and like hard this work can be on your own mental health. And I think that there's a part, I mean, I don't know, but I feel like a part of that probably has something to do with the fact that like, this is very like, you know, virtuous, valiant, and like, and necessary work. And so there's almost like putting your shit aside for
like a
others.
Call to service. Sort
yeah,
of thing.
But when in reality, right. like if you don't have that ability to actually take a moment to step back and go, you know what, I need to change the scenery for a minute, or I need to find a different way to contribute that isn't in the shit. You know, if you don't have that, then you're kind of just rolling through PTSD without knowing it.
You can be, and you know, that happens a lot. It happened with COVID,
yeah,
in totally. The hospitals with 24/7 people being there and coming mm-hmm. home and trying to see all the deaths that they were seeing, and mm-hmm. you know, you need support, and a lot of that, if you have a family that's very supportive, where you're able to go back to work every day, you know, yeah. that's key, I think.
I would love to dive into talking about HPV a little bit, and especially from the vantage point of where the type of work that you do. So I think it's not that it's pretty well known, I think, to most people that HPV is a sexually transmitted illness that is pretty like almost universal. You know, there's a lot of people that have HPV, whether they know it or not. And I think that, you know, most people are somewhat aware of that, but I think the place where it might fall off that people aren't super familiar with is the fact that HPV isn't just something that is affecting women in a like sort of cervical cancer type way. I think that's the what most people think of HPV. They think of cervical cancer. They don't think of oral cancer. They don't think of anal cancer. They don't think of, you know, maybe there's other ways that I'm not even aware of how HPV can affect the human
penile
body.
Penile like, cancer.
There we go. Okay. Holy shit. Fuck. Damn it. Fuck.
You can get cancer in your penis? Yeah.
Yes, you can. The same kind of cancer that women get on their cervix.
Okay. Okay. So
in their hooch.
In the same like sort of rates though, or not?
No. So okay. Penile cancer is really. Is really rare.
I was like, why are we talking about this?
but oral cancer is really increasing, mm-hmm. even more common than cervical cancer that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And it's really starting now in the last couple of years, just because, you know, sexual habits changed quite a bit in the 60s and 70s where there's more oral yeah. sex.
Can you tell us a little bit about high risk groups? Because,
yeah.
We were having a discussion actually in your hot tub about a year ago, and I was talking about how my partner, who's, you know, she's 30 now, in order for her to get the HPV vaccine, she has to pay for it. And one of the things that we realized in the process of her looking into this was that gay men in Nova Scotia are able to get the HPV vaccine covered. But she's not. And I was like, why is that? I don't understand why that is. My lack of knowledge of what constitutes as a high risk group when it comes to HPV.
Well, let's just first just talk in general about HPV. You were correct. It's the most common STD or sexually transmitted infection, STI. But most people think they've never had it. So almost anyone who's had sex has had HPV. So, you know, when I see people that have warts or precancerous area, they're like, oh my God, they're like freaking out. Like just because they didn't have an outbreak of something to see, they assume they don't have it. But everyone, even you guys, have all had HPV, whether you've cleared it or not, it's another story. But if you're sexually active, it's spread by skin-to-skin contact, you're going to get it. And it's spread by touching, rubbing, and feeling. So if you're rubbing genitals and skin around that area, that's how you're spreading HPV. Because I have some people that say, I've never had receptive anal sex before. How can I have this inside of my bottom? And it's like, well, because HPV can crawl, and if you're rubbing, touching, feeling around your opening there, you can infect the inside of your bottom too, not just the outside skin.
Damn, that sounds scary.
Well, it is, but it isn't. And the thing is that it shouldn't be scary because we all have it. Okay. So there's nothing really you can do to prevent you from getting it except getting that vaccine before you start having sex. When I was eligible for the vaccine. It wasn't available. But now, you know, all these parents are not vaccinating their kids because they think it's going to promote them from having sex. But it's really the only cancer prevention vaccine we have. It prevents all of those cancers that you had mentioned in those locations.
Wow.
And the other thing with the vaccine with your partner is that the vaccine's approved between the ages of 9 and 26 here in the U.S. But in with shared decision-making for certain groups, it's also approved up to age 45. So the vaccine prevents you from getting infected with HPV, but it can also be important if it's someone that has multiple sex partners to get the vaccine after your age of 26, because it will prevent you from getting infected from possibly some strains you haven't had before, which is why it's okay at age 45.
Like if you had HPV and if you have HPV and you haven't cleared it and then you received the vaccine, is that also protecting against spread as well?
No. So it doesn't really do anything for the HPV that's already persistent in the cells in your various locations, but it prevents you from getting reinfected again, because you can get reinfected if you cleared it. So it's still important that reinfection, because the thing that causes cancer is a persistent infection. So in women with cervical cancer, for them, most women get infected right when they become sexually active. And if they're going to clear it, they usually clear it by age 30 or 35 because they're married. Usually they don't have a lot of other, you know, sex partners, and their immune system takes care of it. It's different with anal HPV in that usually for most gay men and for certain high risk groups, it's going to persist forever. And it's that persistence that causes those changes in the cells there over time that can cause cancer in some people.
This is like, there's a piece of this that's really blowing my mind, because after the COVID vaccine and the sort of chatter about how mRNA technology, you know, might be bringing about a new era in cancer vaccination to, you know, protect against, you know, certain types of cancer that are, you know, really common in our society. That all sounds, as I've seen it in the news over the past couple of years, like this brand new thing, like in terms of cancer vaccines, if we kind of take that term, like a brand new thing that's yet to be realized. But we have that in an HPV vaccine, essentially, that it is, you know, it falls into the category of a cancer vaccine. Ultimately, it's an HPV vaccine that prevents the development of the cancers that develop as a result of HPV. And I feel like that's not as well known as it should be.
It's not. And, you know, this month, March is HPV Awareness Month. So we're trying to get, you know, the message out about vaccine and also treating and screening for these precancer areas. But that's not really something that's out there. And we're trying to get that message out more, that for people that are younger, that need to be vaccinated, they really should, because it prevents cancer. Mm. But we should also be doing that for older people. Mm. But when you're talking about, you know, who are the high risk groups of people for anal cancer, it's traditionally, first of all, background, anal cancer has been a cancer of women. But you never really hear anything about it because the numbers are really, really low, even though it's a cancer of women. Mm-hmm. So the incidence is like 2 women per 100,000 will develop anal cancer in the general population.
Yeah.
In men, in the general population, it's about 1 person per 100,000. So really low. So you're not going to hear about it. But in high risk groups, so for instance, the highest risk group are HIV positive men who have sex with men, or MSM. You know, the rate's about 170 per 100,000.
Oh, wow. Holy
shit. In women that have had vulvar precancer areas or cancer, their rates are about 30 to 40 per 100,000. Hmm. So still really high.
Yeah.
So when we're targeting these high risk groups, those are the ones that we really should be screening and focusing on, because their rates are really high. And as a comparison, just so you can kind of think about it from a cervical cancer point of view, people freaked out when the cervical cancer rate in the general population was 30 to 35 per 100,000. Now with screening and treatment, the rate's about 7 per 100,000.
Yeah.
Anal cancer rates are really high in some people.
For people who are curious about anal cancer, we actually did an episode a couple of years ago. The episode is titled "Mommy Has a Lump in Her Bum." And the link to that episode will be in the show notes of this episode if you want to check it out. Also, I want to clarify, if anybody goes to my LinkedIn or our LinkedIn, you will also see that we have the postnominal MSM. And just to clarify, that's actually Meritorious Service Medal.
It's a Canadian, it's a very prestigious Canadian, Canadian medal of distinction,
right.
and not MSM.
But we're also doing our part by leaving that there to make people who are curious, because right. when you search MSM, you're going to find what Dr. Bucher is talking about right now. So there we go.
Are you tired of hearing the same old wellness advice? It's time to dig deeper and listen to America Dissected from Crooked Media, the podcast that's cutting into the science, culture, and policy that shapes our health. From doctors fighting for their rights to the surprising truths about sunscreen, America Dissected dives deep into the state of health. Tune in every Tuesday for new episodes of America Dissected, available on all major podcast platforms.
We have talked now from where you sit, Gary, from the perspective of a medical professional. You'll probably find this pretty stupid and silly, but we've often talked about humans just being giant donuts, that, you know, from your mouth to your anus, you're just one big hole, you know. But at some point, the mouth becomes the throat, and the throat becomes the stomach, and then the stomach becomes the colon.
Yeah, it's a complicated hole.
So where is the line for anal cancer? Where from the opening of the anus, how far up are we going before anal cancer stops becoming anal cancer?
Great question. So HPV infects certain types of cells, squamous cells. So the type of skin cells you have on your outside skin, right? So when those skin cells are infected, we have two different types of HPV. We have low-risk types and high-risk types. Those low-risk types cause warts or kind of hang out, or plantar warts on your feet or hand warts that you may get, but they don't cause cancer. Those high-risk types infect the same types of cells, but those have the potential with a persistent infection to lead down that path. So in your anus or your asshole there, your perianal skin is the skin right at the opening on the outside. And as that outside skin goes in, it goes in about an inch. And then it transitions. It's called the transformation zone. It transitions into cells of the rectum, which are columnar cells. And up higher, they're colon cells. So HPV doesn't infect your rectum or your colon because it doesn't like those cell types. Huh. And on those same cell types in the cervix and in the vagina, when those cells transition from outside to inside, it's the same type of cell. Same thing on your penis, same thing in the back of your throat as your outside skin goes down the esophagus, that transition zone. So that's where it really likes to hang out. And when I first started doing this, it was funny. On the requisition, I would do my biopsy, which are really, really tiny, like sesame seed size. On the requisition, I would send to the lab. I'd put, sex, age, location. I get the report back. It says cervical dysplasia. And I have to call up the pathologist and said, are you looking at the sex? Doesn't have a cervix. Under the microscope, those types of skin locations look exactly the same.
Wow. Okay.
Which is why HPV likes those types of cells.
I'm curious.
It's only about an inch. So a colonoscopy, they go past. They're not going to even be looking at what I look at.
Because
they put the tube in, the colonoscope, and by the time they get past the sphincter, they're already past the area that I look
at. They're pushing those cells even further in.
They're not pushing them in, but they're definitely not seeing them.
We are a wealth of disinformation.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you clarified when you said anus and then clarified and made sure that we knew you were talking about asshole, because you got really science heavy there and I had no idea what you were talking about. But well, I'm glad
we're going to sometimes.
I'm curious, could you make has anybody thought to make a tool, like a guard that you could like fit to your asshole that like maybe goes in that inch, that is like a protection that you could, if you wanted to have penetrative anal sex,
like an anal dam. Like, an
yeah. Like you could just like sort a, of like right. go oh through God. The hole, like into yeah. the thing, and it would protect that.
I
like
think
skin
condoms
to,
do that.
Oh my God. You've never heard of an anal condom?
No. What's it? Wait, like just a regular condom?
There's actually a real, there's oh, like, such a real thing.
Oh, wow. I don't even know this. Anal condom.
Like yeah. It's like a vaginal condom. So some women can right. insert a hole, like, you know, it's like yes. a barrier.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same thing for the anus.
It's called the something ring, the vaginal one. What's it called? It's like a, I forget the name of it. But it's basically a slinky. It's
a plastic bag that you put in your yeah. vagina.
Yeah.
Same thing that you would just insert into your anus.
Yeah. Not unlike an accordion. It's like a slinky that you pull apart, but it's closed off. Yeah.
Okay. So I have a question, actually, a serious question on that. Do condoms help to prevent HPV transmission? Because you're still rubbing skin to skin when the condom doesn't protect that far down.
You are absolutely correct. So there is probably some protection, but you have HPV at the base of your penis. You're not going to cover that. So yes, you can still spread HPV that way.
Yeah.
Unless you're into saran wrap, you know, all the way around yeah. and just rubbing that way. That would
yeah.
And there's a lid
barrier.
I'm sure there's a community that's
yeah. There's a lid for every pot, as Dr. James Cantor says.
That's
and,
right.
And that there, I'm sure there's many lids for those pots.
Yes, there is.
I would one other kind of question since we're on this, because I find this is all so fascinating. I love this. Thank you so much, Dr. Gary. But vaginal pap smears versus anal pap smears. Is there a difference? Or is pap smear just a general term for smear just the procedure, or like are they very different?
So the official term for both of those would be a cervical cytology or an anal cytology. And we call them anal paps and cervical paps. And they are exactly the same test. So they're actually looking at the cells that are scraped off with a Q-tip or a swab. They're put in the same solution. They go to the lab the same way. And again, if we didn't mark on there where the source was, they would probably be confused as to which location it's okay. from.
Mm. I would love to, jump into the myths. You said you literally have a list of myths that you're going to now add one that we brought to you, which, you know, you can invoice us later. Before we get into
the
myths.
We can invoice you. We'll invoice you.
Yeah. Before we get into the myths, I would love to, I'd love to cover the anchor study and the anchor study sites, because, just interesting to know that there's I think there's upwards of 21 anchor sites, and the work that you guys are doing at your clinic are kind of leading the charge there. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I will. So the anchor study is the anal cancer prevention study, and it's a National Cancer Institute clinical trial. And it's really one of the most amazing studies that NCI has ever had. And the reason is that we have a lot of different types of locations with HPV disease, right? Mm-hmm. But there haven't really been any randomized clinical trials, as an example, for cervical cancer and screening and treating those precancer cervical lesions to prevent anal cancer. People were just doing it for years and years and years. And they found over time that cervical cancer decreased. Well, now with evidence-based medicine, all studies really require randomized controlled trials. So this study was put together to see whether treating these precancer lesions in the anus would prevent anal cancer in these high-risk groups of people. And the highest risk group is HIV-positive persons.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought we were going to have to screen 15,000 people nationwide. but we actually only had to screen 10,000 people to get our number of 4,400 some people to prove that treating these pre-cancer lesions prevented decreased the incidence of anal cancer by 57%.
Mm-hmm.
So the study started back in 2015. We've had 20 some sites around all of the U.S. Our site itself, out of those 4,000 people, enrolled 600 people. So we were like one of the second highest enrolling site in the country.
Okay.
For that. And we randomized people to either a treatment arm or a monitoring arm. So we actually watched people every 6 months to see who would develop anal cancer. In the treatment arm, if they had those precancerous lesions, we would treat them. And what we found is that, you know, the incidence for people with these precancer lesions in the monitoring arm that developed, the incidence for them was like 407 people would progress out of 100,000 to cancer if they weren't treated.
Hmm.
And we still had, you know, some cancer in the treatment groups because the treatments aren't always 100%. But, you know, the rate was significantly lower. So they stopped the trial. They said, hey, it's not fair to have people in this study that aren't being treated because you're preventing cancer. And so we stopped the trial back in September of 2021, and we've still been following up these same individuals actually until the end of this month, our study visits in. So we've still been following them in a post-study scenario. But it's remarkable because we've gathered over a couple million different samples, swabs, blood work, and those are stored in a big biorepository at University of Arizona. And the thing that the National Cancer Institute loved about it is that we have this big biorepository, so we can answer questions related to how should we be screening people? Do we have any new biomarkers that we can like test this tissue with and see whether we should be treating that lesion or this lesion or which lesions are going to progress to cancer? And it can be extrapolated to those other sites like oral, penile, cervix,
right,
because it's the same stuff.
Right.
It's really exciting. And they loved it. And they loved the anchor study because 60% of our participants were African American, and that never happens in clinical trials.
Yeah, right.
So we had a great diverse patient base.
Dr. Bucher, I'm really like, I feel this feels like such a full circle story for you. And I'm curious from like a personal perspective, what it feels like to go from someone who is, you know, personally affected by the work that you did in your early career and seeing the sort of toll that this takes on individuals and their families, and then getting to the point where you're part of this, you know, massive study that's proving that these treatments are effective and work and are saving the lives of thousands of people. Like, what does that feel like for you?
You know, I think for me, how that makes me feel, I mean, I've been involved in my career with two of the most, you know, two very significant health issues, HIV being one, where it was basically a death sentence when I was doing HIV primary care in the mid-90s until the protease inhibitors came out, and it was just like people started coming back to life. It was just such a stark contrast, and it changed the way healthcare was done in HIV-positive people. And the same thing, I feel the same way with what's happened with treating these precancer HPV lesions for anal cancer. It's like there was nothing, it's going to be changing the standard of care of how we take care of these high-risk patients. Insurance companies are going to have to pay for screenings and these treatments because it works, and we've actually proven it. So, you know, in my career, having to be involved with these two types of areas, it's been really fulfilling.
And cancer is such an invasive, it's just such an invasive disease, you know, like there's just so, I have no idea how many types of cancer there are. I know that it's just an astronomical amount, and
if you live long enough, you're gonna get it.
It just seems like it's whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
So like to be able
way
to,
less fun
to be able to really treat, be able to really effectively treat a cancer, like that's just like such a big,
mm-hmm.
that's such a big deal.
It is a big deal, and we're not treating cancer. What we're treating are pre-cancer lesions to prevent cancer.
Dysplasia.
Anal,
right?
Cancer.
That's what
it's
dysplasia
anal,
is.
It's, yeah, anal dysplasia. It's high-grade mm-hmm. dysplasia, mm-hmm. or we like calling it pre-cancer. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that anal cancer, the treatments for it, for them, are so horrific. Mm-hmm. So if someone is diagnosed with anal cancer, you know, the standard of care is to treat with chemo and radiation. And the problem with that, or with other cancers, you know, if you have a recurrence, you're able to go to another chemo or another treatment. With anal cancer, you get one shot and one shot only, because if that cancer recurs, they're going to have to cut out your butthole, sew it up, and give you a bag.
Yeah. Turn you into Ken.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that even speaks, I think, to just even like the increased importance of that work, because when I, my somewhat knowledgeable, but largely, you know, surface level understanding of cancer is that like cancer that is found early is very manageable. Like, you know, yes, obviously there's exceptions to that rule, but like, cancer is a disease of time, that if you,
right,
if you catch it late, it's bad. If you catch it early, there's a lot of options. If you can do something that comes before the cancer developing, that is
best case.
That is what we want.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And just the other thing with the anchor study. So just, we were screening all of those people. So we had people come in for these exams. We found cancers in people that didn't even know that they had cancer. So they were able to like get them treated before they were even having symptoms. Mm. And if you catch these anal cancers early, 70 to 75% of those are curable. Mm. If you catch them very early. Mm. So they didn't even know it. So that's the other thing, by these high risk groups, having them screened, they're going to be able to catch things early that they might not even know. Mm. And, you know, part of doing that is breaking this taboo about, you know, having your butt checked out. It's like we have to destigmatize it. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Because patients don't want to talk about it. Their primary care doctors don't want to talk about it. And if they both don't want to talk about it, then no one even looks at it.
I mean, people don't even want to look at their own asshole. You know, like,
no.
Like, isn't that, I make a point to look at my own asshole once a month.
How do
I
just you do feel it? Like, what's your technique?
That's good.
I stand in front of the mirror. I got a floor to ceiling mirror. I stand in front of it, and then I do a forward fold with my asshole facing the mirror, and I look between my legs behind me into the reflection. I've got a very pretty
I also
butthole.
Do this because I've got a particularly itchy area right on the outside of my butt that's perpetually itchy.
You might want to get checked.
And so
that
I'm
could
always,
be
and so
a dysplasia, Brian. Taylor, we never know.
I have a question about that. So sometimes in particular for like hairy men who have really hairy butts,
probably harder.
It might be harder for them to see it. Is there any benefits or downsides to having your butthole waxed?
There's not a benefit for that as far as preventing anything or looking. But, you know, I think for people that are in high risk groups, being aware of what their outer skin looks like there is probably pretty important.
Yeah.
And I know, Jeremy, you said you bend over and you're looking in the mirror.
Yeah.
A better way might be is just to put a handheld mirror on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
Walk down over it. Right. And, you know, it's kind of easier to see.
Yeah. I was gonna say
I would flashlight action.
Yeah, I was gonna say like the front facing camera on my phone, but I don't want Zuck to. I don't want Zuck looking.
Yeah, you don't want Zuckerberg.
And also, Brian, to the benefits and risks of, I'm sure there's risks with getting Brazilians or getting your asshole waxed, but one of the benefits is it makes wiping a dream. And I know this, and it doesn't hurt that bad.
I was thinking about doing it.
Awesome.
I have kind of a surprise. Like
let's make it.
You got to stay
little,
on top of it.
Let's make a double date.
Because the stubble, because like when it starts to come back
no,
in
it
and it's really short.
No, it doesn't. You don't even feel it. But I mean, you probably, because you're a goddamn fucking troglodyte. You're so hairy, it probably would come in real.
But actually, Taylor and I are the opposite. Like, Taylor has hair all over his body, but his butthole, he's like a hairless baboon.
Don't worry,
like
Dr. Booker. I'm going to rein this in here in a second. You got to let him go for a minute.
Yeah, and I'm a little bit more hairy on my butt.
I do.
No, that's okay. But the one thing I did want to mention, besides waxing your butthole hair, the one thing that you probably shouldn't be doing, you know, you've heard of anal bleaching.
Oh, yeah. Who is doing that?
I don't know. I don't know why, but that's probably one thing that people shouldn't be doing. Because one of the things as a butt doctor, we're looking at the skin and we're looking for discoloration and different subtle changes. So that kind of stuff will mess up really what kind of a good evaluation that they probably need because – you know, they're using chemicals and things to lighten it. I don't know. Sorry, you're talking about that bleaching.
For some reason, I was thinking anal, like perineal sunning. But yes, right. But I mean, no, which don't do that either. Don't do that. Trying to lighten things up. What's the point?
Like, just to make it
so that it doesn't.
It's an aesthetic thing.
So it doesn't look like a poopy butthole.
Yeah. But like, isn't the skin sort of just
some soap and water?
Yeah. I know exactly. But it's the look. I think people are weirded out because they're like, oh, my butthole's like, maybe my butthole's brown. Like, or, you know, like the sphincter is like a darker color than my skin. So I don't want.
Right.
But like, come on.
Yeah.
Just get a bidet.
We just need to get rid of it.
Get a bidet.
Yeah. Just make sure you're doing
your butt and show Zuck your butt. Okay. I want to wrap this up. But before we do, I would love to hit a couple of the myths that you have come across that you feel are out there, you know, among the general population to kind of clear the air so that people heard it here first on Sick Boy. That's it. CBC. Here we go. Let's go.
So one of the myths is that when someone is having some anal bleeding, what do you think? So if you had anal bleeding, what would be the first thing that popped in your mind, the reason for that?
Hemorrhoid.
Mm-hmm. Hemorrhoids.
Wiping too hard.
Yeah, that actually probably that.
It's really hemorrhoids. So people, you know, will go to the doctor. They tell them that they have that, and the doctor doesn't even look. And so they can have a mass there that's bleeding for a while, that's getting larger, and it's not hemorrhoids. So we have to get people not thinking about hemorrhoids if they're having anal bleeding.
And do you mean that because like they're going to, you know, they go in and they say, hey, my anus is bleeding, I think I have hemorrhoids. And the doctor goes, okay, well, if you think you have hemorrhoids, I'm just going to assume it's hemorrhoids.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So remember, the patient doesn't want you to look and the doctor doesn't want to go there.
Yeah. Right.
I just had this experience. My wife just gave birth and like, she was like, I've got hemorrhoids from pushing during birth. And I had this experience 4 days ago in my doctor's office, and it was just like, yep, here's what you do for hemorrhoids. There's not a check. It's just
right.
It's
right.
Just, yeah. Okay. Not a check.
And maybe Kyla should have been like, it could be hemorrhoids, but I think I need you to look, 'cause I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the point that Gary's making is like that there should just be a check. Like it should just be, let's take a look and make sure, you know,
totally.
It should just be a normal check.
Okay. I like that one.
And you know, the other one is that, oh, I know I don't have anal cancer, or I don't need to be checked. I just had a colonoscopy and it was normal.
Right.
So again, whoever's doing the colonoscopy is not looking at the anal canal.
Ooh,
you know, it's only that first inch. They put the scope in and it goes right past that.
They're not even taking like a quick peek. Because they're
going past, you know, the sphincter. So it's already kind of like tightened up on the scope,
and also,
so they're past that, and by then they're in the rectum.
Yeah, right. And you're also using the HRA, right? The high resolution.
Yes. So they need to have a high resolution anoscopy.
Anoscopy. HRA, there we go. Right.
Meaning that we're using some iodine, we're using some acetic acid, which is just plain vinegar, because it causes these precancer lesions, which you wouldn't normally see, which the colorectal doctor that's doing the colonoscopy isn't using those. He's not going to see those unless it's something that's really obvious. You have to use those to highlight them and use the magnification to be able to see them.
Amazing.
I have a quick question, myth or fact. Is there an increase in transmitting HPV for people who enjoy eating ass?
Yes, of course.
Oh. Let's ask the doctor.
That for anal cancer or oral cancer?
Well, like I guess both.
Could be for both. Mm-hmm. So again, so if you're having oral sex, anal sex, tongue wise, you know, it's you're rubbing, touching, feeling the skin, but you're also exposing, you know, the skin in the back of your throat. So that's also like when with women, you know, doing vaginal oral sex. That's why men are at the biggest risk for throat cancer.
Huh. Can you, like, is there a way to decrease the risk and still enjoy the performance of that said activity?
So most people don't have any issues with HPV. So you should still be going out, performing, having fun, doing all the same things that you normally do.
Okay.
Going out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go at it.
Yeah. Okay. Sweet.
But if you are in certain high risk groups, then you need to be screened.
Right. Yeah.
Because that's just how it works.
And lower risk if you're with the same partner performing the said activities on a generally frequent or regular basis.
Right. So if you're with your same partner and you're really not having any outside partners, you know, over time, the longer you're with that person, you're not going to be reinfected with other strains from other people. So whatever strains your partner has, you have, and what you have, your partner has. And obviously, it's probably not causing any issues or problems.
Okay, so generally increase.
Brian, yes, you can eat ass, dude.
Just to clarify.
You love eating ass.
Just to clarify.
Just eat away, man.
Generally.
Fill your plate.
Generally increase.
Tom. He's a fucking hungry boy.
Tom. He's a hungry boy. Like it.
So guys, relative increased risk, but relatively the risk is low in this case. Like if you're not part of one of those groups, I'm talking about myself.
Yeah. Right. Asking for a friend.
Yeah. Right.
Who is me?
Maddie is so happy. Right now.
So let's just go over those high risk groups again. So gay men who are HIV positive, mm-hmm. Gay men who are HIV negative, mm-hmm. Trans women, especially who are HIV positive, HIV positive people over age 45, the other groups like men and women, women who have a history of vulvar cancer or vulvar precancer. Mm-hmm. And the last one are transplant patients. If they are post-transplant 10 years because they're on those immunosuppressants. So those are the biggies.
Yeah, which actually, you know, was something that that dysplasia was something that came up in a recent podcast that we did with a transplant patient. Doctor, I mean, this has been fantastic. Your wealth of knowledge, you roll with the punches. It's been a real delight chatting with you. If anybody is in the Midwest area, you know, and they perhaps feel like they could use the work of your services, where can people find ADC Midwest?
All right. So actually go to our website, adcmidwest.com, has our address. We're in Lincoln Park on Clark Street in Chicago, Illinois, but has all the information and our phone numbers on the website, adcmidwest.com.
The home of Scruff McGruff.
Chicago, Illinois.
60652. Let's do it. For some reason, the only fucking U.S. commercial that every Canadian has gotten somehow, and the jingle is just rammed into our brains. Forever and that was burned. 25 years ago.
Yep. Wow.
Doctor, thank you. Thank you so much. This has been very fun.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, that enough butt stuff. That was a lot of butt talk. And
let's keep it rolling.
As much as it pains me in the butt to know that we're not going to be talking about butt stuff forever, it's nice to know that we had a good, solid, almost hour with Dr. Bucher.
He was
fantastic,
guys. This brings new meaning to what my therapist always says, which is no buts, ands.
I love a doctor who doesn't mind using the word asshole
yeah,
to describe a butthole.
Isn't it approachable?
Yeah, it's very, yeah.
It's
yeah.
also nice, again, and I'll repeat what I said, it's also nice to hear a doctor correct himself after saying anus by going, sorry, asshole.
Yeah, it's very refreshing. Very refreshing.
I got one thing that we're going to be talking about for the wrap up here. Let's talk about polio.
Okay.
Oh,
holy molio.
I feel like I know where you're
going
with
this. Don't
spoil it. Are we going to talk about, I don't know where we're going with this, but are we going to talk about our pal in the iron lung?
Maybe.
That's a spoiler. That's a textbook spoiler.
So,
it can't.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
But how can you spoil something you don't know?
Well, maybe someone listening actually has no idea what polio is. And actually, probably the chances are really high that someone listening doesn't know what the fuck polio is or doesn't. Think it like feels like they got the fucking scoop on polio, because I don't know if you guys noticed this, but when COVID became a thing, there was this really funny, not haha funny, but like ain't that funny thing that happened where people were really up in arms about vaccines.
I do recall.
And if you thought vaccines caused autism before COVID, then after COVID, you probably think vaccines make your cock fall off. There's a lot of people in the world, especially in North America, who are on the vaccines are the devil's work train. And here's the thing, polio, I mean, holy molio, we almost eradicated that fucker.
I thought it was eradicated. Like, was it
not really? Not in almost fully.
I think Western Africa still has.
I meant in the West.
But it's back, baby. Polio is
here.
Yeah, polio is like there's rising cases of polio because people are you got two choices: you get autism or you get polio. And most people are going, well, I'll take my chances with polio. But here's why you might want to rather. Get autism. polio, short for poliomyelitis, is a highly infectious viral disease. So it's viral. That primarily affects children under the age of 5. The poliovirus is transmitted through person-to-person contact, not unlike anal dysplasia.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Skin-to-skin contact.
Yeah. But again, we got to be very careful here because I just said children under the age of 5.
Oh, sorry. So
and we're talking about polio. We're not talking about buttholes and genitalia.
Right. Well, we weren't until you started.
I just want to be clear.
Okay.
So it's transmitted through person-to-person contact or by consuming contaminated food and water. It invades the nervous system and in a fraction of cases leads to paralysis. We'll get to that, Brian, which can be life-threatening when the muscles used for breathing are basically kaput. There are 3 types of wild poliovirus, type 1, type 2, and type 3. And they get wilder and wilder the further you go.
Is the first one water polio?
I was trying to think of like a wet t-shirt joke there because I was talking about wild poliovirus, but...
The best thing to do would just be to ignore it.
Yeah. So each of these types, type 1, 2, and 3, are capable of causing paralysis or even death. However, type 2 wild poliovirus has been eradicated.
Oh, strip polio.
And significant progress has been made towards eliminating types 1 and 3.
What?
Shut the fuck up. strip polio.
Right.
So the disease itself can manifest in several forms, okay? The vast majority of polio infections are asymptomatic, meaning that they cause no visible symptoms. Approximately 4 to 8% of cases result in minor symptoms, such as fever, fatigue, nausea, headache, flu-like symptoms, stiffness in the neck and the back. Less than 1%. So, you know, those things there, I'm not making this judgment, but I would guess someone on the other side who is on that sort of vaccines are bad camp would read that and go, well, that sounds better than autism. But keep listening, fuckhead. Less than 1% of polio infections lead to paralytic polio. the most severe form, where the virus attacks the nerves of the spine and the base of the brain. And this can lead to paralysis, typically in the legs, and in some cases, the muscles involving breathing, like your diaphragm, resulting in the need for mechanical assistance, like an iron lung, which was something that was, you know, in bygone days, the iron lung. Despite the severe consequences of polio, it is a preventable disease with effective vaccines.
That's what they want you to think.
Right. That's what people want people to think.
They quite literally do want people to think that.
And we actually do want people to not think, believe that vaccines are effective and
have been for a long time.
Regardless of whether or not they have anything to do with autism. I mean, anyway.
Which they don't.
Yeah. As far as, it depends on who you ask, I guess.
Well, yeah, but they don't
do your own research on who you're asking.
It's interesting. I saw yesterday.
I hope people understand that the joke here is that if you believe that, take your head out of your ass.
It is interesting to note, just like on the autism part, and then I'll give you your space, Brian. I won't steal it from you anymore.
Thank you.
The whole thing with like the autism and vaccines, just to be, because I was surprised when I learned about this, that I thought, before I learned this, I had heard that and I had thought, oh, perhaps that is like a super rare thing that can happen, but like it's so rare, like why, like it's like the risk does not outweigh the reward.
And then you thought about that for like two minutes, you thought about it, and then you were like, whatever, and you forgot about it. And then the next time you went on YouTube, like your whole algorithm was just Jordan Peterson dominating some cuck woman.
Yeah, but this was like years and years ago. This was, yeah. I don't know, like 10 years ago maybe or something. When that kind of thing first started kick it up, and you just kind of, you hear it and you go like, whatever.
Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey were actually one of the early, and that whole thing is based
on one person, one research paper that like, to, you know, fully just debunked and yeah. you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's not, it's so easily find outable that is bogus. And I just wanted to clear that up because I feel like it's not hard for people to just assume that like maybe it's true, but it's like it's this you know, super ultra rare occurrence of a vaccine. But it's not at all hard when it doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's challenging when you have people like RFK Jr. just screaming it from the rooftops, and it's like, God damn it. Like, can we get some people running for office that, I don't know, are just kind of chill, you know?
Yeah,
Let's get some fucking chill bros.
The position doesn't really call out to chill people.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, sorry, Brian, you have to have your space now.
No, I mean, it's not even really, I'm just going down the same hole that you guys were, but I was looking at an Instagram account, news Instagram account yesterday, and it was like a picture of the newspaper, and it said, like, just to let you know, vaccine boosters are available at your local pharmacy.
Let me guess, the comment section was hilarious.
It was hilarious, yeah. And,
and they, not they, fun, but, like, ha-ha hilarious? Hilarious, like, huh, yeah, that's
yeah,
hilarious.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for the clarification.
But it's interesting because, like the headline wasn't like, you need to get your booster now. Everybody, like, there's only a certain number. It was just like, hey, just so for you know, your information, this is available. Yeah, yeah. And, like, the comments are like, they're still trying to fucking get us. And like,
there's adrenochrome. they're putting adrenochrome in the vaccines.
I just can't imagine living, like, they talk about fear-mongering by the media, yeah. but, like, the fear-mongering that's happening in those comment sections when people are, like, taking, you know, this informative headline that like this is available and saying that it is, you should be afraid of
the ironic thing about the whole thing is trying to use reason to get into the mind and understand why.
And also
it's like you're using reason to try to understand insanity.
Yeah. I just want to say this to anybody out there who's listening. The date today that we're recording this is the last day on our contract that we signed with Zach Churchill and Big Daddy Trudeau. Like we just had to like, we just had to do this. We just have to say this stuff about the vaccines. Like vaccines are good. We're just saying this until, so like, I think today at midnight, that contract's over. So we'll be back to, to the way we actually feel next week.
And you know what? Not to pour onto this, because I know we don't want to talk about polio, but like not to pour any more onto this, but, and that's not to say that shit doesn't happen. That there's not shit that can happen when you get a vaccine. A vaccine can do shit. Fucking this,
eye drops.
My mother-in-law, exactly. My mother-in-law didn't get it from a vaccine. She got it from getting COVID, but it can happen from getting a vaccine. It can happen from getting like a number of different viral infections. She got Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Yeah.
And it causes partial to like full paralysis for 2 to 3 months, and has like a year long recovery associated with it. Like there are things that can happen.
Now, would she have rather got autism though?
But it's important to be able to discern what are the actual things that can occur and what are the things that are fucking nuts.
I've been trying to like practice kindness more lately, but there's this little fucking thing on my shoulder right now, just going like, just talking into my ear going, oh man, just think it. I fucking hope someone stumbled across this YouTube channel and is listening to this going, these fucking cocks.
Oh yeah. It'd be great.
They definitely are, but they didn't make it this far. They've already turned us off.
They've already gone.
Yeah. All right. No more politics. Let's move on to, we've got some breaking news.
That is a long stinger.
What would you say in those circumstances? Oh, I think you've got to.
What? Fuck! I'm on. Fuck off! I'm on live telly. Fuck off! Out of it. Stay out of my office. I want to fucking hell. Fuck off, you little twat.
Oh, whoopsie.
Wow, what an over the top reaction.
We are cutting back. You know what? We're going to let them figure that out.
He really poured gasoline on that fire, didn't he?
While we do, Oh, there's some more breaking news coming in. So, our friend.
Stinger? Do you want to do the stinger again?
Yeah, might as well here. Breaking news. No, I'm joking. We don't have to sit through that. The Iron Man himself, Paul Alexander. We covered him a while back. Paul Alexander, the Iron Man, if you didn't listen to our episode, I don't know, 15 years ago, we talked about this man. He was one of the only people in the world who was still living in an iron lung, lived in Dallas. He passed away at the age of 78.
Dude, how long was he? He was in the iron lung for like 50 years or something,
wasn't he? In that iron lung for a long time, 70 years confined to an iron lung. A consequence of getting a vaccine. No, just joking. Of contracting polio.
I don't think they say confined to an iron lung. I think they say an iron lung user.
He might have. But I will say this. And Brian, you are right. Language does matter. And some people who use wheelchairs do not like that term.
Confined. Who said anything about wheelchairs?
Confined to a wheelchair.
Who said anything about? That's not.
But I will say, Paul most certainly was confined to an iron lung because he could not get out of that thing without dying immediately. So he got polio in the 1950s when he was a child. He was born and raised in Dallas, Texas. And my guess is that he never really got far from Dallas.
The iron lung looks pretty stationary.
This guy was a fucking homebody for sure. So,
he was, yeah.
I'm so sorry. I feel bad now that I'm laughing about his iron lung situation.
No, it is very, you're not laughing about his iron lung situation.
No. All right.
No, I'm laughing.
Let's move on. Right. So Alexander was diagnosed with polio at the tender age of 6, which resulted in, I had said earlier, paralysis. Specifically from the neck down, and this necessitated the use of an iron lung to assist his breathing. So again, he did not have the muscle control to breathe. So my guess is like his diaphragm, you know, his intercostals, like all those things didn't have the ability to work. And so we covered Paul on the podcast a number of years ago. And here is a picture of Paul in the iron lung. He was basically, so if you don't, if you're just listening and you're not over on YouTube, go on over to YouTube, hit subscribe, press the notification button so you get notified every time new episodes come up. But I will describe this for just our audio listeners.
What's that Instagram account?
Like secret buttholes.
Secret buttholes.
That's a secret butthole. Right
that
there.
Is it a is, secret yeah. butthole. Yeah. So an iron lung is basically this very large hyperbolic chamber. It looks like a little yellow submarine. And which actually, the Beatles might have been singing about an iron lung. To be honest with you,
I mean Paul's at that time Paul's that checks out.
Yeah. It looks about as claustrophobic as the Ocean Gate sub. Yeah. And
more reliable though.
And probably would have done better than that sub if you put that thing.
Great meme throwback.
20,000 leaves under the sea or whatever that is. So this man, his entire body from his neck down to his toes is inside this chamber. And there's a secret butthole that wraps around his neck mm-hmm. and his head is being pushed out like a little dookie. And he is facing, so he is laying on his back. So for 70 years, this man laid on his back.
Fuck, that's so nuts.
Looking
man.
Straight up and about maybe 2 feet from his face, there's a mirror that's angled so he can kind of look around the room. He would write with his mouth. So he would take a pencil into his mouth and he would write. He, you know, when he drinks his coffee in the morning, he has a little mug next to his head with a bendy straw. And this clearly doesn't give a fuck about turtles. I'll tell you that much, because those bendy straws are plastic. So,
and I read the bio.
So with the death of Paul Alexander, we might have saved one sea turtle.
I read some of the bio on him and like his life. I mean, first of all, he's an impressive man. I mean, just simply for having the mental fortitude to live in that lung for that period of time is like, I can't even begin to try and wrap my head around it. He got his law degree.
Yeah.
Like he did nuts.
Here he is
things.
Prior to his days in the iron lung in a wheelchair. Handsome fella. And this photo was taken back when black and white photos were only photos taken.
Can you imagine? He lived in an iron lung from when there was only black and white photos
until the induction of AGI.
Until there could be an app that has a page where only photos of things that look like buttholes are shared.
Yeah. Here is a video of Paul.
Only has watched very carefully because it's a hideous.
I mean, this machine is archaic as well.
It's horrible because it's so contagious and it's the extent of damage to human beings.
So this video is from about 6 years ago.
Mine was extensive. One of the worst cases ever recorded. And I'm still here. But I watched thousands of kids in my ward, through my time, at Parkland die of it. That had considerably less problem.
So you can hear there in the background the machine running, which is basically like through pressure, forcing his body to breathe mechanically. So the iron lung, it's a 600-pound mechanical respirator encased Alexander's body, excluding his head, and functioned by creating negative pressure to facilitate lung expansion and contraction. This machine, now largely obsolete due to advances in medical technology like modern ventilators and tracheal intubation, was a lifeline for Alexander and a symbol of the era when polio was a widespread threat. For our Gen Zs out there, you
widespread means that it was happening
all over
in multiple locations.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for clarifying that, because Nathan definitely didn't know what widespread meant. But what I was going to say was, you Gen Zers out there might not know this, but a lot of our parents, a lot of millennials who are children of baby boomers, our parents oftentimes have a weird little scar on their shoulder, right on their delt. And it's the scar from the polio vaccine. So didn't give them autism, but did give them a pretty cool little, it looks like someone took a penny and just branded your arm.
Why did that happen then? Like what changed that made that not happen?
Maybe you mean the scar.
Yeah. I mean the scar, like, how we administer the vaccine.
No, you probably administer it the same. It's probably an ingredient.
Oh, wait. Oh, it wasn't a poll. It was a smallpox vaccine scar. Ah, smallpox was a contagious disease, yada, yada, around 30%.
They would have still used needles. Like the needles wouldn't
have changed. People who have had the smallpox vaccine may have a permanent scar on their upper arm in the area where they received the injection. The smallpox vaccine usually left behind a distinctive round scar on the upper arm during the healing process. Having a scar is typically a sign that the vaccine was successful or that it took. Yeah. So if it burns, you know, it's working. So my bad, smallpox, not polio. That's you learn something new every day. So Alexander's resilience and determination were evident in his academic and professional accomplishments. Like Taylor said, he not only obtained a law degree, but he also successfully passed the bar exam on his back, with a mirror in front of his face and a pencil in his mouth, becoming a practicing lawyer.
Cool. Do you think they had to make accommodations for him for the exam?
I would say
it was a home exam.
Additionally, he authored a book sharing his life experiences and insights gained from living with polio and within the confines of an iron lung. Beyond his personal achievements, Alexander was a vocal advocate for polio prevention and vaccination. He utilized social media platforms, notably TikTok. Hey,
whoa!
How about that? So that old fucker was on TikTok, not doing dances, probably, but he was on there to raise awareness about polio and the importance of protecting children against this now rare but still dangerous disease. A video he posted in January of 2022, where he expressed his commitment to talking about polio and the necessity of vaccination to prevent another epidemic, garnered 56 million views, reflecting his wide-reaching impact.
You know, it's crazy. When all the vaccine sort of kerfuffle was going on around with the COVID vaccine, it was really evident to me, and I'm sure a lot of people, that like this was going to cause downstream problems at some point for the world, in like who knows what way. But when we're talking about like polio popping up in North America again, I really thought that those things, those consequences of such a larger population of people being, unnecessarily skeptical of vaccination, I thought that that would be way further down the road.
Yeah.
Like I thought it would be I thought it would be a 10, 15, 20 year thing. I didn't think 2 years after we sort of like put COVID in the rearview mirror, we'd be facing something like that.
So COVID actually played a role in Alex's demise. Before his death, he faced a significant health challenge when he was hospitalized with COVID-19, which is particularly dangerous given his reliance on the iron lung. And although he was released from the hospital, his condition remained fragile, and he announced a hiatus from creating videos on social media, and that ended up being his final update. So as of the time of Alexander's passing, I believe this was a couple of weeks ago, might have been last week, polio remains a concern in certain parts of the world. Like you had said earlier, parts of West Africa and Asia. But recent findings of the polio virus in New York City sewage and environmental samples in Montreal, Canada, underscore the ongoing risk and the critical importance of maintaining high vaccination rates. Health officials, including Canada's chief public health officer, Dr. Theresa Tam, emphasize the vaccine's effectiveness and the need for up-to-date immunizations to prevent the disease resurgence. So just vaccinate your kids, dude. Come on.
It's just kids that need the polio vaccine, right? Like if you got it when you were a kid, you don't need like a re-up.
Well, I mean, if I don't know if we got a polio vaccine. I don't know. Like, did we get polio vaccines when we were kids? Do you have kids now? You have two now. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Do they get those? Or do you just give them distemper?
I believe, actually, I've got a new card at home that like details all of them. I can't remember because there's like, you get like 6 month ones, you get 1 year ones, you get 18 month ones, and some of them have multiple doses. It's kind of hard to keep track of, to be totally honest with you.
But you're getting the ones that the hospital is.
I pick and choose.
Yeah, you've been doing your research and like choosing which ones are best.
Children, I feel like I know best.
Here it is. Yeah, children usually get the inactivated poliovirus vaccine IPV at ages 2 months, 4 months, 6 to 18 months, and 4 to 6 years. Sometimes IPV is given in combination vaccines with other vaccines. In this case, a child might receive a fifth dose of IPV and it just says period. This is safe, period. This is safe. Rest in peace to our...
Man in the Yellow Submarine.
I mean, I wasn't going to say our friend because we unfortunately never got a chance to meet Alexander. But he was someone who was on our radar to have on the show, and it just never came to be. Which is one of the downsides to doing the show is that, you know, we hear of people that we want to chat with, and sometimes we reach out and find out that they have passed. And that's this is one of those moments where prior to reaching out.
And he was celebrated like everywhere. There was an article in every publication about him when he passed.
Get your kids vaccinated. Stop listening to fucking weird freaks on the internet that tell you that vaccines are not safe, yet, you know, they're injecting their own piss into their eyeballs and snorting cocaine. I mean, if you want to do that, go ahead, do it, but also get your vaccinations.
Do both.
Thanks folks. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed that. This was really fun. And big shout out to Dr. Booker, not Butcher, for all of that really insightful information on butt stuff. We loved talking to him, and I think we will probably get him back.
Assholes.
And thank you for listening. If you're tuning in on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, that's awesome. Leave a rating, leave a review. On the Spotify mobile app, hit the Q&A underneath this episode. And of course, if you're on YouTube and you are supporting us there, we really appreciate that support. Leave a comment below. And again, like this video, because the more people that see the video, the better it is for all of us involved, because this podcast, although silly, is actually doing some pretty good work in the world of health. If you didn't know this, we are the reason why I would say upwards of 15 plus men have gotten circumcised because their foreskin's all funky and they didn't realize. And now they got the snip and they're just jackhammering all over the place with condoms and butt condoms, and they're not spreading HPV. And that's all because of us. So if you want to also add to the conversation that spurs after each of these episodes, head on over to Discord. You can find that link in all of the show notes of our episodes. And we would love to see you over there because we've got a thriving, fun Discord community, and we love each and every one of you who are already there.
And if you want to be a guest on our show, go to sickboypodcast.com. Fill out the guest form. Let us know why you want to be on the show.
Do it. And also, if you didn't know, we've been producing podcasts lately, primarily for health associations, and they're like this, but not like this.
They're not like this at all.
They're not like this at all. We make branded. We make branded audio documentary podcasts for organizations,
and they have no sway with the Liberal government or the Conservative government at all.
And so, if you're interested in how maybe your health association can produce a podcast with us, head over to wearesnack.io and fill out the form there.
That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Jeremy, and this is Zickler.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.